Life Talk Radio presents Health and Longevity, the program dedicated to bringing you cutting-edge information and interviews that can change your life. On each edition, nutritionist, registered dietitian, and board-certified anti-aging health practitioner, Dr. John Westerdahl, will show you how to achieve a longer, healthier life using the latest breakthroughs in nutrition, wellness, and lifestyle medicine. And now, here's your host, Dr. John Westerdahl.
Welcome to Health and Longevity. I'm Dr. John Westerdahl. You want the healthiest diet for you and your family, but it is so confusing today. It seems that food myths abound on the internet and everyone claims to be an expert. Who should you believe and what is the truth? Our special guest today on Health and Longevity is Dr. Steve Chaney, PhD, the author of the book, Slaying the Food Myths, the Truths Behind the Headlines. But before we get into today's exciting topic, let's hear the latest news and research affecting our health and longevity today.
Dr. Westerdahl presents the Health and Longevity News and Research Update, bringing you the most pertinent and important information about your health and longevity.
Well, the health information about today and in the media today is that there's a lot of misinformation in regards to health information being spread on the internet and through the social media. And we're going to address that problem in regards to the food myths that are being spread with our special guest today, Dr. Steve Chaney, PhD, who's the author of a book that I highly recommend. It's called Slaying the Food Myths, The Truth Behind the Headlines. If you want to get information about the book, go to ChaneyHealth.com. That's ChaneyHealth.com, ChaneyHealth.com, to get information about the book. And let's go to the interview and learn more about these food myths.
And now, Health and Longevity's special feature, where Dr. Westerdahl interviews leading experts and personalities on vital topics important to your health and longevity.
Our special guest today on Health and Longevity is Dr. Steve Chaney. Dr. Chaney is an award-winning professor who taught human metabolism and nutrition to medical students at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill for over 40 years. He is an internationally recognized scientist who has published over 100 research studies and reviews and peer-reviewed scientific journals. And he's the author of his book, Slaying the Food Myths, The Truth Behind the Headlines, and that's what we're going to be talking with Dr. Chaney about today. And Dr. Chaney, thank you for being with us today here on Health and Longevity.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got interested in food and nutrition and how you came to write this book.
Well, it's a long story, but actually, when I talk about it in the foreword to the book, but growing up as a teenager and in my 20s, I ate pretty much like everybody else. Hamburgers and French fries and soft drinks were my friends. And a favorite place to eat when I was a teenager was Amato's Pizza. So you can kind of get the idea. I was not exactly a health nut when I started out. But when I got married, things began to change. My wife had been brought up. Her mom was, I guess we would qualify her as one of the original California health nuts, which means that she actually believed that organic food was healthier. She actually believed that you didn't want to eat all that processed food. So I actually learned a lot from her, and she challenged me. And, I was a graduate student at the time, so that means I was a skeptic in training. And so I didn't necessarily immediately accept everything that she shared with me, but I liked her well enough that I really went on to investigate it. And the more I read, the more I realized there was something here. So gradually, over a period of years, I changed my diet. And then when I got my biochemistry degree and I started teaching at UNC medical students, my topic was human metabolism. And of course, you've studied human metabolism. I know your daughter just got her medical degree. She got human metabolism. And that can be really boring if you're just talking about metabolic pathways. So I try to make it alive for the medical students to really talk about nutrition and how, the nutrients we eat are metabolized and how that affects our health. So that really, that was sort of the genesis of where I came from. And then I think the recognition that a book like this was needed started in my years as a professor, you know, because the students who I had them first year, the very first course that they had, and they came here as a cross-section of the population. Many of them believed sort of bizarre food myths, ones that could actually harm their patients. So I had to teach them not to believe everything they saw on the internet and social media. They should actually read the clinical studies. And then I also had to teach them how to evaluate clinical studies. And then once I retired, that was my first real exposure to all the false information on the internet. You know, up to that time, my reading had been in the scientific literature. Very little time spent on the internet. But once I started seeing what other people were reading and seeing on the internet, I realized where people were so confused, because one day they were told one thing, a week later they might be told the exact opposite. And, you know, on the internet, if you're the general public, everyone is an expert. Mr. Google can just lead to confusion. So who should you believe? What's the truth? Some of the topics that I cover in this book are things like, will saturated fats kill you? Are they good for you? Is meat your poison or your friend? Are grains poison or are they good for you? Is low carb best or is it low fat? Should you go vegan, Mediterranean, paleo, keto? These are the kind of questions that are in people's minds. And by the way, if you're following social media, you're following the internet, one day they'll be heroes, the next day they'll be your enemy. So, you know, this is when I realized that this book was something that was really needed.
Well, the book, again, is Slaying the Food Myths, the Truth Behind the Headlines. And there are many headlines that's confusing everybody. They say one thing one day and another thing another day and the exact opposite the other day. So it's no wonder people are very confused. But tell us a little bit about how do these food myths really get started?
Well, so that's an interesting question. So let me start with something I call that the secret only scientists know. Now, really, I'm talking about the scientific method. But there's some things about the scientific method that most of the general public really doesn't understand. And unfortunately, many medical doctors don't understand either. So just in terms of my background, I also headed a cancer research lab for 40 years. I published over 100 scientific papers in peer-reviewed scientific journals. So I knew how to design experiments that were worthy of passing peer review. But I was also part of the peer review process, which means that I reviewed a lot of manuscripts in my career and got to be really expert at analyzing the studies and the design of the studies and how they were carried out to really separate the good science from the bad. So a couple of takeaways once I started reflecting on what people know and don't know about the scientific method, well, there are two things that I think most people don't understand. And that is every study is designed to disprove an existing paradigm. There's no glory to be the 10th person to prove an existing paradigm is correct. The glory comes from being the first one to disprove an existing paradigm and establish a new paradigm in the process. So that guarantees that there are going to be published studies on both sides of every issue. So the second thing that most people don't understand is every study has its flaws. There's no perfect study. So what scientists do, what a good scientist does, is we don't just take one study and say, oh, that's a great study, I'm just going to go with that. We usually try and wait until there have been 10 or 20 studies on a given topic, and then we look at which studies are really good studies and what do the majority of the good studies show. That's why, you know, when you hear a scientist describe their study or their work or do a review, they almost always say, but there are more studies that are needed. And I know that's terribly frustrating to the general public. That's why we say what we say, because we're looking for enough studies all leaning in the same direction that we can start to say, this looks like something that we can say is generally true.
Yeah.
But that's just the science part of it. The problem is the media hypes every study. Now, back when in my days as a professor, media was newspaper, magazines, TV, and radio. Now it's blogs, podcasts, social media. But one thing hasn't changed. If you're out there doing a podcast, your goal is to attract readers. And that means that in most cases, you're going for the spectacular. You're going for the controversial. You're going for the man bites dog story, or what you learned yesterday isn't true because. And the thing is, the pressure is immense because you've got to have something spectacular every single week. So people kind of go over off to the dark side sometimes. And then there are some of these, and what really bothers me is the medical doctors that have blogs and write books, post on the internet, and really should know better. I call them the Dr. Strangeloves of the world because I don't want to offend anybody in particular. But they cherry pick studies that support their bias rather than doing what good scientist does and say, well, what do the preponderance of studies support? So that's how these things get out there.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of repetition.
Right.
So Dr. Strangelove posts it, or if social media influencer posts it, and then somebody repeats it and somebody else repeats it. And pretty soon people, you know, the general public is looking and seeing, I've seen this in enough places, it has to be true.
Right.
That's where they come from.
So the myth becomes a reality to them, but it's still a myth. Now, I'd like to elaborate maybe on a couple of the food myths that you talk about in your book. And let's start with your section. You had a nice section in there called protein proficiency. And I know you've questioned some of the recent headlines in the New York Times that's claiming that most Americans get too much protein. I mean, many of my colleagues and myself have actually said that because we don't have protein deficiencies like they do in some of these other countries, which are really protein calorie deficiencies. But isn't it true that most people get more protein than they need?
So let me just kind of put this into perspective. Anytime I talk about a food myth, there's always a kernel of truth there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's absolutely true for some people, but it's not necessarily true for everyone. So, for example, it's certainly true for most middle-aged couch potatoes, and it's also true for teenage boys. And the thing with teenage boys is they eat so many calories, they're not deficient in just about anything. They're sort of bulletproof in terms of nutritional deficiencies. But everybody agrees, most experts agree, that protein intake can be problematic for teenage girls, pregnant, and lactating women. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're protein deficient or not getting enough protein. But what experts have recognized for years is they have increased protein needs at a time at which many of them are following restrictive diets to try and control their weight or to try and lose weight. And when you put those two things together, you start to have a significant number of them that are at least marginal in terms of protein intake.
Yeah.
It's also problematic. So recent research has shown it's also problematic for adults over 55.
Mm-hmm.
There's something called fancy scientific name of sarcopenia, but basically that means we start to lose protein as we age.
Yeah.
It gets harder to build protein, easier to break it down.
Right.
So the solution to that is a mixture of resistance training, that's where you're pumping iron, but also increased protein intake. So the studies are coming in somewhere, the needs of once we're over 55, in particular, as you get to 60, 70, 80, our need for protein is about 1.3 to 1.5 times the RDA.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, if we are still all eating the same amount of protein we were when we were younger, probably still not a problem. But this is a time of life when many adults are simplifying their diet. Could be they're trying to lose weight, or it could be health issues that have surfaced. And now they go online to see what they should do about it. And they get on these bizarre diets that are cutting out whole food groups. And pretty soon, they're really not eating. They're not getting enough of the protein they need. As they get older, it could be finances. It could be mobility. A lot of things go into this. But again, it's that same combination of increased need and sometimes not enough intake. One of the really interesting thing about that is the research shows that the protein utilization is best when it's spread out during the day. So some protein with each meal. Now, if you're in your 30s, 15 grams of protein per meal is plenty. But if you get to your 70s and beyond, it's 25 to 30 grams of protein per meal. So forget the continental breakfast, salad for lunch, and a protein-rich dinner. That's not necessarily going to do it. So for somebody like me who's in their 70s, it's not that I don't try to get the protein by just increasing calories, but I'm mindful that I include protein with each meal.
Very good. Now, what about athletes? Some of them consume large amounts of proteins. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, so one of the things in the book, what I did is I relied on recommendations for an International Society for Sports Nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
That's because they probably done more research or more looking at the clinical studies that have researched this question than anybody else. And what they do is their recommendation is 1.7 to 2.5 times the RDA for exercising individuals, and that's based on intensity of exercise. That 2.5 would be Olympic athlete type of exercise, but still more protein than the RDA. Now, you're perfectly right. That's no problem for gym rats because most of them are supplementing. They have their protein shakes and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
But it could be problematic for those adults who aren't focusing on protein intake, especially the seniors who need more protein. So again, it's a matter of increased need. And then we start to look at the population group who may not be meeting that need. So it's not that athletes are going to be deficient, but protein can be problematic if you are a senior and you're not focusing on your protein intake.
Now, of course, a lot of people go on high-protein diets today because they're popular weight loss diets. Do those really work, and are they really needed?
So that's another interesting question. Sort of, I think people have a misconception about diets. In an ideal world, when we cut calories, we would just lose fat. That's what everybody wants. But the reality is our body isn't designed that way. We lose muscle as well as fat. So because both of those are energy sources. Muscle can be converted to carbohydrate. Muscle protein can be converted to carbohydrate. Fat, of course, can be converted to fat. We use both as energy. So we mobilize both energy resources when we cut out calories in our diet. So the solution to that is, again, a combination of resistance training and increased protein intake. And studies that have looked at it find that 2 times the RDA is about optimal. If you do that and you combine it with appropriately designed resistance training, you can actually retain the muscle and lose the fat. Going above that in terms of protein intake gives you no additional bang for your buck. But here's the problem. Once again, a lot of people losing weight, they think about going eating salads, rabbit foods, or they're restricting their calories without thinking about whether they're getting enough protein. Once again, it's a combination of increased need, and some people aren't focusing on the protein they need.
And of course, some of the high-protein diets that are real popular right now are the paleo and keto diets. What's your thoughts on those? Because very popular today.
So that's interesting. And again, the thing to keep in mind about those is they're not just high-protein. Those are also low-carb, high-fat, high-saturated fat diets. Now, the interesting thing is that people have compared low-carb and low-fat diets. And what happens is you get faster initial weight loss with a low-carb diet. But once you go out 1 or 2 years later, it's virtually identical. So the other question we need to ask is, what are the long-term results? What are the health benefits of these diets? Because, you know, the paleo and keto have this health halo that the claim is that they're healthier for you.
Right.
So if you look at low-carb, high-fat diets, the Atkins diet is the granddaddy of these diets. It's been around for more than 50 years.
I've actually debated Dr. Atkins a couple times on the radio.
So it's been around for more than 50 years.
Yeah.
There's still no published evidence that it's healthy or results in permanent weight loss. 50 years, there's no evidence. Paleo and keto haven't been around long enough for a long-term study, but what we do know, when I really looked into this, there were some studies that were very interesting. They said the results of the studies were for people who consumed meat-based, low-carb, high-protein, high-saturated fat diets for 20 years or more, their results were identical to people who were consuming the standard American diet for weight gain, diabetes, and heart disease. In other words, there was no long-term benefit in terms of lower weight, less risk of diabetes or heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
But people who consumed plant-based low-carb diets,
Yeah. They
were also high protein, but now they're high in unsaturated fats.
Right.
They did significantly better than people who were consuming a standard American diet in terms of both weight loss and lower risk of diabetes and heart disease.
Yeah, now you're talking about plant-based there, and that's more vegan diets, and that's all in that category myself. But there are vegan diets, and there are vegan diets. How do those provide protein? Do they provide enough, from your opinion?
Well, so again, you are the expert on this.
Yeah.
I really should have having you talk about this part. But you know, the point is that properly designed diets do.
Right.
So what I call expert vegans do fine. I would rate you as an expert vegan.
Yeah. Now, there are vegans, of course, that, you know, a vegan diet could be Coke and potato chips. Where's the protein there, you know, on the junk foods? But it's amazing the protein you can get in plant foods, like a cup of split pea soup. I mean, that's right. About 20 grams of protein right there. And there's actually some good protein powders today from pea protein and soy protein that you can blend up in a smoothie with other healthy plant foods that it's very easy to get the protein you need on a vegan diet.
It is, but the problem is, you know, that they're, you're talking junk food vegans.
That's the problem.
But they're also what I call amateur vegans. So they're not eating the junk food, but they don't really know what they're doing. They just know that they should be eating plant foods.
Yeah.
I've had people tell me that broccoli and greens are going to give them all the protein they need. And you can actually find that in some of these websites
right. By
Dr. Strangelove and Associates.
Yeah.
And that's just not going to cut it.
Yeah, they're thinking of the idea that where do cows get their protein? Well, they're eating huge amounts of those. They are getting it from plant foods, that no question, but you'd have to get large amounts to get it. But that's where you get to focus in on little beans and the legumes and nuts and things like that. And I think the convenience of some of these plant-based protein powders that you can put in smoothies and add to your diet are very good. And without the cholesterol and saturated fat.
Yes, absolutely. So, and my sort of final word is that you don't need to go nuts about this.
Right.
You just need to focus on including some plant-based protein with each of your meals.
Right. Right. Choose. You have another section in your book, and boy, we're going through fast things. But let's talk about your section there on sugar silliness. You actually touch on several food myths about sugar in that section. In some of the remaining time we have, in the next couple minutes here. Let's talk about sugar. That's the other problem Americans get too much of in the diet in many cases.
Well, again, there's a kernel of truth there, and that is that most Americans are getting too much added sugar in their diet. So, you know, I have to put that up front because some people look at what I say about sugars and they start to assume I'm a sugar fan. I'm not. But I think the emphasis of the sugar myths that we hear is in the wrong place. So, I mean, you know, my first topic is there are no sugar heroes.
Mm-hmm.
There are no sugar villains. You know, we've heard that with age comes wisdom, and I don't know about that. But with age comes perspective. So when I was a young man, sucrose was the villain, or table sugar. Sucrose, table sugar, that's the same thing. That was the villain.
Right.
There was a book called Sugar Blues, and we were told to avoid sucrose and table sugar. And so the food industry said, okay, people have been told to avoid sugar. Now, we don't want them just going and eating whole foods, fruits, vegetables, and that sort of thing, because we're not going to make any money. So he said, hold on a minute. Don't worry about it. We'll just take all your favorite processed foods and we'll put something else in its place. That something else was high fructose corn syrup. So nowadays, high fructose corn syrup has become the villain. But here's the deal. High fructose corn syrup is indistinguishable chemically and biologically from the so-called healthy sugars.
Right.
Honey, sucrose, coconut sugar, date sugar, fruit juice sugars, all of those are just chemically and biologically identical to high fructose corn syrup. Now, if you go to something like agave sugar, that's even higher in fructose.
That's right.
So there are no sugar heroes. There are no sugar villains. There's no perfect sugar out there. But here's the second point. It's not the sugar, it's the food.
Right.
Now, the interesting analogy that I like to use is the same amount in same types of sugars, and it's high fructose corn syrup in your average 8-ounce soda and a medium apple. Now, I think everybody knows that an 8-ounce soda is probably not good for you. Medium apple is healthy. An apple a day keeps the doctor away, and there's a good reason for saying that. Of course, it isn't just apples, it's other fruits and so forth, but what's the difference between an 8-ounce soda and a medium apple? Well, if you drink an 8-ounce soda, that sugar goes into your bloodstream immediately. You eat an 8-ounce apple, and now that sugar is mixed with fiber, but also it's entrapped in a cellular matrix. So first you have to digest and break down that cellular matrix, and then it's just also mixed with the fiber. Both of these things slow the absorption of sugar.
That's right.
So instead of going in minutes, it goes in over an hour or so.
Right. So that's a nice thing. We're running out of time right now, Dr. Cheney, but the idea is that sugar from whole foods and like fruits, like an apple. By the way, there's a lot of pectin in that fiber that can help you lower your cholesterol, too. There's good studies to show that. So there's other things when you're getting the whole food as opposed to the processed sugar, as you point out, it's absorbed differently and you're getting some phytochemicals and the fiber with it. I mean, it's a lot better for you. Dr. Cheney, tell us a little bit about how people learn more about your work. You have this book here, Slaying the Food Myths, the truth behind the headlines. We could talk hours on this topic, but it's all in this book. And you have another one on food myths about dietary supplements and so forth, and other great sources of information. How does one get the books and learn more about your websites and so forth?
Well, the best place to find the books is to go to cheneyhealth.com.
Spell that out.
C-H-A-N-E-Y, health.
Okay.
H-E-A-L-T-H.com.
Right.
And then just click on health, click on resources when you get to that website.
And you have books and other materials, right?
I have books and other materials. Also, you can sign up for my weekly free blog called Health Tips from the Professor.
Health Tips from the Professor. How do they get that? There's a link on your website, Cheney Health.
And a link on the website. You go to cheneyhealth.com, click on Health Tips, and there's some examples there. You can see the latest ones, and you can sign up to get it. It'll come by email to your inbox on a weekly basis.
Well, Dr. Cheney, I want to thank you so much for the great work you are doing. You're showing people a better way of living and through good nutrition and healthy living, and making a major contribution with the education that you provide to audiences all over the world, actually, today. And so keep up the good work, and thank you for being on the program today.
Glad to be here. Hope I was helpful.
Thank you.
Would you like to live a happier, healthier, and longer fulfilled life? Then visit us at healthandlongevityradio.com. That's one word, healthandlongevityradio.com. There you'll find valuable information and resources that can help you achieve optimal health and give you the secrets to longevity. Visit us today at healthandlongevityradio.com. Once again, that's healthandlongevityradio.com. It could change your life.
That's all for this week's program. Tune in next week at this same time on the same radio station to hear more of Health and Longevity. Until next week, this is Dr. John Westerdahl wishing you the best of health and longevity.
This has been Health and Longevity with Dr. John Westerdahl, a production of Life Talk Radio. Join us again next week on the same station and time for Health and Longevity. The preceding information on this program has been general information about your health and is not to be taken as professional medical advice, nor is it intended to serve as a substitute for medical attention. Do not change your diet or exercise habits without guidance from your medical doctor, especially if you have health problems or are on medication. Do not change your medications without the advice and supervision of your medical doctor. If you have a medical condition, we encourage you to seek the consultation of a medical doctor experienced in dietary change and lifestyle medicine. And as always, we wish you the best of health.